Good morning. This is Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Scott Cameron. Illinois' new medical marijuana law, which took effect on the first of the year, includes the line, "Modern medical research has confirmed the beneficial uses of cannabis in treating or alleviating a variety of medical conditions." It goes on to list cancer, multiple sclerosis, HIV/AIDS. The reality is somewhat less clear, though. While people in 20 states can legally use marijuana for medical purposes, we still know very little about cannabis's ability to help alleviate pain, nausea, and other symptoms. Later this hour, the director of outreach for Get Covered Illinois on the final push for signups under the health care law. But first, the challenges of doing research with medical marijuana. It's something Dr. Suzanne Sisley knows firsthand. She is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. She joins us now on the phone. Welcome to Focus.
Thank you so much for the invite.
Oh, sure. And your experience really is just the latest example of some of the challenges involved in studying medical marijuana. You've proposed a study to test how cannabis affects a number of symptoms related to post-traumatic stress. The FDA approved that plan back in 2011. Have you started trials yet?
No. We only got our approval letter about 2 weeks ago from the Public Health Service to move forward to actually purchase the marijuana study drug from NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So you can see there's a number of regulatory hurdles. Some of them are appropriate. You know, we need to protect public safety. But to wait 3 years after initial FDA approval is really concerning, and it really creates obstacles that a lot of investigators around the country feel are just too onerous to even tackle. And that's why you don't see very many scientists trying to examine this area, unless it's pharmaceutical companies.
Okay. And this is, at least in part, because marijuana is considered, you know, it's a Schedule I drug, among the most dangerous drugs under federal law. And getting approval for the study is one hurdle. I mean, that's taken, you know, 3 years now, as you say. Actually getting your hands then on government-approved marijuana is another process. Where does that come from, and how do you get access?
Yeah, well, back in 1999, the government established a second redundant review process by Public Health Service. And that's the real problem, is that Public Health Service has no timeline to conduct this second review, unlike the FDA, which is on a 30-day timetable where they have to respond in a month. Public Health Service has no timetable. They can take 10 years, 20 years. If they don't review, you know, if they never give you the approval, then you're never allowed to proceed to purchase the study drug from NIDA. And NIDA is the only legal source of marijuana for any FDA-approved trial. So
NIDA
has a government-enforced monopoly.
In NIDA, that's the National Institute on Drug Abuse?
Yes, they're a department of HHS.
Okay. And so what? So you've got FDA, because you're talking about human trials. You've got NIDA, and you've got DEA.
Yeah. And we still have to overcome the DEA hurdle. We have, and again, they have no timetable either, so they could take quite a while. But we're hoping all the public pressure, the pressure from all these dedicated veterans groups around the country have really helped propel this forward. I don't think this would have come about without scrutiny from all these vets and from the media. So we're really lucky that we actually got our letter finally.
So in terms of the process then, once you get that DEA approval, where does the marijuana come from?
Yeah, then there's a cultivation center at the University of Mississippi that's owned by NIDA and managed by them. And so once the DEA does their inspection at the University of Arizona and feels that the location for where we're storing the study drug is acceptable to them, then we'll be allowed to actually purchase study drug. We'll send NIDA a list of the marijuana that we need. According to our protocol, we're requesting marijuana in 5 different dosages, including a placebo control, so a 0% THC all the way up to 12% THC. We've asked for some different strains, including one that's a little bit higher in CBD, cannabidiol, which is a very important area of research. Now, cannabidiol seems to be a cannabinoid that has no apparent psychoactive effect, so it's a growing area where people want to study the potential to provide, you know, pain relief and other, you know, medical benefit without causing any cognitive impairment. So, but the problem is that NIDA, it's not clear that NIDA can even produce high CBD strains. No investigators around the country have ever seen this come out of their facilities. So that's the other reason that groups around the country are now petitioning the DEA, asking them to allow a second cultivation facility that would have maybe more sophistication to produce these unique hybrids, because it's crucial that, you know, we have 20 states now with medical marijuana laws. We desperately need this kind of research on the whole variety of different hybrids, not just THC.
Yeah, and I can hear the frustration in your voice. You describe kind of the multiple steps that you have to go through here. Is that process common for research studies? If it wasn't marijuana, it was some other plant, say, or another substance entirely, would that lengthy process be the same?
No, that's the strange thing. I mean, when you look at research on other Schedule I drugs, there are no other Schedule I drugs that have this second unnecessary review by Public Health Service, and we view that as the major blockade to conducting this. So once the FDA has approved any other Schedule I drug, whether it's LSD or MDMA, ecstasy, these drugs, you know, simply once they get FDA green light, they move to be implemented. But this one, you know, you have to go through this, what we call the NIDA monopoly, which is NIDA has to, you have to purchase study drug from them and them only after you've obtained this Public Health Service review. And all of us in the medical community are just baffled by this, because why marijuana would be the only Schedule I drug subject to this unnecessary hurdle is indefensible. When you look at the other Schedule I drugs that seem, you know, considerably more toxic than marijuana, I mean, overall, marijuana seems to have to be fairly benign. It has relatively low toxicity. And for this to be the one that the federal government wants to go to the mat on doesn't make sense to us.
Yeah. I mean, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, you know, there have been some studies that have shown some damaging effects of too much marijuana, changes in the brain, similar to schizophrenia by one study, memory loss, other things. I mean, isn't the government just, in some sense, doing its job in setting a high bar and being very cautious about studies involving cannabis?
Sure. No, I think a high bar is important, but when the FDA, the most important scientific regulatory body in the country, says that your study is merits, you know, has scientific merits that are worthy of being implemented, that should be the high bar. And that is the high bar with every other drug development study in the country. Only marijuana is subject to this unnecessary review. And we've called on our congressional delegates around the country to sign on to a letter that would be sent to HHS asking them to end this Public Health Service review. And we've got a ton of support from congressmen in Arizona and all over the country who are now signing on to this, and we'll be presenting this letter in April through the Americans for Safe Access, their lobby day conference.
All right, so that's kind of the process, and we get a little microcosm of what goes on in trying to, the challenges in trying to do research with marijuana. Let's talk about your study. Can you describe what are you doing and what do you hope to learn from it?
Yeah, we're going to be looking at 70 combat veterans who have treatment-resistant PTSD, so meaning they've failed multiple medication trials and they've failed psychotherapy. And so these vets will be randomized into one of those five different dosage arms, and then they'll also be randomized into one of two delivery methods, either a smoking arm or a vaporizer arm. And so we'll be following them for about 12 weeks, and then they'll have a year-long follow-up afterwards. So we expect to hopefully enroll about 20 patients in year one, and then another 50 patients in year two, and then the whole study will probably take about 3 years in total to conduct, and then we'll be analyzing all the data and attempting to publish it in peer-reviewed journals so that we are determined to put this out into the public domain as soon as possible so people can start to scrutinize this data, and hopefully it will be immediately clinically relevant. We want this data. That's why it was so important to us to study whole plant medicine, because we're trying to meet patients where they're at. What patients are doing are using the whole plant, unlike what pharmaceutical company research is looking at marijuana at the molecular level, at the receptor level, trying to mimic or synthesize certain cannabinoids. So far, that hasn't been very successful. You know, the attempt.
And that's so they can put them into pills and things.
Right, right. So they can patent it and make money. And our goal is, you know, we've got millions and millions of patients around the country that are utilizing this whole plant to relieve their suffering, and many of them are doing it successfully, and we want to understand how that's working. How does this drug get absorbed? How do you dose this plant? What hybrids are best for what symptoms? And so we're hoping that we can illuminate some of these, you know, the answers to these questions and more. And this is an early phase trial, but hopefully it'll provide enough data to spur on other research and maybe, you know, motivate other investigators around the country to continue this momentum.
So you've got 70 veterans, you said, PTSD. They haven't responded to other forms of treatment. What are you looking for? What are you testing for in this study?
Yeah, well, primarily the hypothesis is that marijuana will ease the symptoms of PTSD in a dose-dependent manner. So we're going to be closely examining the severity of their PTSD to see if they do get some relief and to what extent. So we have all kinds of testing that's done. There's a scale called the CAP scale that has, you know, special certified raters. It's a very rigorous scoring system to evaluate the severity of PTSD. So we're going to be monitoring that throughout. We have a battery of other psychological tests, so including, you know, rating suicide, concerns about psychosis, depression, anxiety. All those issues are going to be measured throughout. We're going to be monitoring blood levels of cannabidiol. We're going to be measuring, you know, monitoring their own subjective clinical experiences through diaries that they keep. And so, but the first thing we do, the FDA is required we do these safety sessions where we actually administer the marijuana on site at the university. That's for two reasons. First, to be able to monitor them for adverse events, because many of these veterans will be first-time users of marijuana, and we want to make sure that if they do have what you described earlier, maybe a panic attack or a psychotic episode, which are actually extremely rare, but if they do occur, we want to be there to monitor it, to medically manage them through the process. And then also we want to standardize the delivery method, because many of these patients probably have never used a vaporizer, for instance. So we have to actually teach them how to use the equipment, how to make sure that each patient is doing exactly the same thing so that it's a truly scientific process.
Yeah. Can you describe the vaporizer there for a minute? I think most of us have an image in our mind of, you know, a rolled cigarette. What does the vaporizer do?
Yeah, well, the most common one that we see is this volcano, and it's basically a way to bring, you know, sort of warm air, move it across the plant material, and then the vapors are blown into a bag, a plastic bag that patients then inhale the medicine from the bag. So the nice thing, what we think is the advantage of vaporizers, is they don't seem to produce any products of combustion, and that's really valuable. As physicians, we don't want to encourage people to smoke anything, but in this case, we'd like to compare, because the truth is that most patients are smoking marijuana, and we need to examine both delivery methods. It would be, you know, negligent for us to just look at vaporizers, because again, we're trying to do a real world study and understand what people are doing right now from day to day. And the truth is, you know, the FDA has approved this smoking arm because they know that there really isn't any data right now linking marijuana smoking to lung cancer or other cancers. So the FDA has approved this smoking arm, and it would have been unethical for them to approve that if they knew that that would have been harmful. So we're going to be monitoring all of this to understand what delivery method might be more optimal, and hopefully reporting on all of that.
Okay, and vaporizers avoid some of the more harmful things that you can get when you smoke.
Yeah, that's the goal, is that you wouldn't have any products of combustion. But again, we haven't been allowed to study vaporizers in this country. I think MAPS is a nonprofit organization in the U.S., and they got FDA approval on a vaporizer study about 8 years ago, And despite FDA approval, the Public Health Service never did give them the green light, and that study is still sitting in the pipeline waiting for NIDA to sell them study drug. So that's unfortunate because vaporizers are a really important area that need to be studied.
So what, at this point, what do we know about the effects, good or bad, of medical marijuana?
Well, there's been tons of trials that have been published, but unfortunately, to do a real randomized controlled trial in this country is the problem. So there's been tons of case reports and observational studies that have been published in legit peer-reviewed journals, but they often don't rise to the level of high-powered randomized controlled
trials.
You
need certain sample sizes and certain, there are certain criteria.
Right, and that's the gold standard. In the medical community, we want randomized controlled trials, especially if we're going to do drug development studies. And that's our goal. Our hope is that we can put marijuana through the proper drug development process that we would expect of any other FDA-approved medicine. And I think it's important for the public to be aware that the FDA is not the blockade here. It's really been surprising to me how collaborative they've been in trying to move this science forward. The physician investigators at the FDA understand the import of this work, and they've been very welcoming in trying to help us optimize our study designs and make this something that will be really valuable for the public, valuable for the data will be valuable for everybody to examine.
We mentioned at the very beginning of the show, kind of describing this catch-22. I mean, I can't think of another drug that's being widely prescribed but hasn't been thoroughly tested in clinical trials on humans. As a clinician, I mean, does it make you uneasy, I guess, that doctors are prescribing marijuana now in 20 states in the District of Columbia as a medication without, I mean, it sounds like really understanding why it works, what kind of dosage might work, what method, how to take it.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes me uncomfortable, which is why I entered the research arena, because I see that there's, you know, a desperate need for this type of high-level science to really guide the physician community and our patients about how to use this safely. So I, you know, rather than just, you know, sitting back and griping with other physicians about why are we stuck as gatekeepers for these medical marijuana programs, instead I decided to, you know, take the leap into the research arena and add to the body of science. But unfortunately, in trying to do that, all I did was run into hurdle after hurdle, and I see why this research has not been able to move forward. And I think that there is enough evidence worldwide to confirm that marijuana does have medical benefits. And I, you know, the bulk of my practice is taking care of veterans and first responders who have PTSD. And after you spend a decade hearing story after story from these patients who have been put through the gauntlet by me and other doctors, put through the gauntlet of every FDA-approved medicine, and either they've had awful, awful side effects or they've just achieved no medical benefit, they finally turn to cannabis after talking to, you know, these patients are reluctant to go there. Many of them have never tried it. They are opposed to using illegal drugs, but they're, you know, often feel forced to move that direction because everything else has failed them. And so when you hear story after story and you look at the current literature that is available, that does seem to confirm that this drug, this plant, does seem to be loaded with medical benefits, and we just need to illuminate those and understand how to work with them day to day with patients and counsel patients. And I think, you know, the data from pharmaceutical companies is many years off, and right now we have patients suffering in this country every day. And so to wait a decade for the pharmaceutical companies to push through their research is not fair to these patients who currently are struggling to be functional.
And there's a long history to this other research. Let's bring Peter Hecht into the conversation here. He's a reporter of the Sacramento Bee in California. He wrote the book Weedland: Inside America's Marijuana Epicenter and How Pot Went Legit. Peter, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, sure. Even listening to the conversation here, is Dr. Sisley's experience unique in facing delays and hurdles, or is this more representative of what we've seen over the years?
Unfortunately, it's more representative. And the amazing thing about medical marijuana research is the lack of acknowledgement by the federal government that even research that the government has approved and authorized has shown positive results. And I come from a state in which California authorized $8.7 million for medical marijuana research, and leading clinicians of the University of California system undertook 15 studies, including 7 clinical trials, with the results of an 8th pending. And these trials, looking at multiple aspects of pain for conditions related from multiple sclerosis to HIV to diabetes to other pain related to damage to the nervous system, showed very promising results for cannabis. And yet, as we know, last year the D.C. Circuit Court, on a legal challenge from medical marijuana advocates, refused to overturn the Schedule 1 designation for marijuana, which basically says that there is no current accepted medical use and there's a high potential for abuse.
So what, after a lawsuit like that, I mean, well, let's go back to the Schedule 1 thing. What does it mean, really, to be a Schedule 1 drug?
Well, marijuana is classified with drugs such as heroin and LSD, and the Schedule 1, which came out of the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 under Richard Nixon as part of the famous War on Drugs decree, pretty much says that these top-tier drugs have a high potential for abuse and no accepted medical use. Now, to give you some context, Schedule 2, it includes cocaine, methamphetamine, oxycodone, and morphine. And while the scheduling says that these drugs have a high potential for abuse, they say they do have accepted medical use with severe restrictions. And then you drop down to Schedule 3, and you have things like anabolic steroids, and ironically, Marinol, which is the pharmaceutical version of marijuana, which is a chemically created THC, which is the psychoactive element. So the fake or pharmaceutical marijuana is Schedule 3, actual marijuana is Schedule 1, and then it drops down to Schedules 4 and 5, which come into more common pharmaceuticals as well as over-the-counter drugs.
Mm. So you mentioned the lawsuit in the D.C. Circuit Court saying the DEA does not have to reconsider the Schedule 1 status of marijuana. In the book, you talk about a number of interactions with various federal agencies. I mean, what are the reasons? What are those federal agencies saying as the reason why they tend to, avoid these studies or try to not encourage these studies?
Well, I think it's a remarkable story that sort of collides between, it's a collision of government resistance and some real evolutions in society. And to understand this is to realize that the modern medical marijuana movement was essentially born during the depths of the AIDS crisis in San Francisco, and thousands of young gay men were afflicted with this mysterious disease, and many of them were starving and wasting away. And as many as 11,000 young men at one point turned to marijuana to alleviate their symptoms and to boost their appetites. And amid this climate, one of the leading AIDS physicians, Dr. Donald Abrams, whose own partner had died of AIDS, and Abrams believed his partner had actually extended his life through use of cannabis, he began petitioning the government to authorize studies to find out, does marijuana in fact have a medical benefit? And he encountered enormous resistance, and the study protocol was rejected. And essentially what Dr. Abrams came to realize, and this is a truism that continues to this day, is the National Institute on Drug Abuse is not inclined to look at anything that would show marijuana having positive benefits. They are very happy to look at what the negative effects may be. And so Hal Abrams pushed it through and finally did get a study launched and ultimately sort of changed the direction of medical research. It's a very interesting story, which I'll get to when you're ready.
Yeah, well, no, go ahead. I mean, because you've led up perfectly to that. I mean, because he did find a way around this
How did he do that? And what happened was, at the time, there was a group in San Francisco known as ACT UP. It was a national group as well that was very, very involved in this issue. It was very frustrated with researchers and not coming up with effective anti-AIDS drugs. And Dr. Abrams happened to learn that a member of ACT UP had died after taking the drug known as ecstasy, and what happened was it interfered with the AZT that he was taking to combat symptoms of AIDS. And so he went back to the government, and using their methodology, he proposed a research protocol that said, okay, we need to find out whether marijuana interferes with the antiviral medications that patients are taking to combat the symptoms of AIDS, HIV.
So he kind of snuck it in under the cover of, he's not trying to say that marijuana might have a medical benefit. He's saying we're trying to make sure there's not a negative.
We're trying to make sure that yet this is not harmful.
Okay.
The government signed off. And this was truly landmark. So they get their government-imported joints from the University of Mississippi, and they're locked into this secured place at San Francisco General Hospital. And under this clinical trial, you had patients smoking sort of a cannabis-scented placebo that had the psychoactive constituents removed. You had them taking the prescription drug Marinol, and then you had them smoking regular marijuana. And what the study revealed was, no, it did not interfere with the antivirus drugs. And guess what else? The marijuana and the Marinol group had significant weight gain during the study. Their cell counts were significantly boosted. The results were marginally better in the marijuana group than the Marinol group, although, interestingly enough, the marijuana group had a less noticeable impairment than the Marinol group. So Dr. Abrams was very politic about it. He said that this is sort of evidence that we should continue the research in this area. And by that time in his life, he had a new partner, and the new partner would later write a book that said that the study, in effect, was a Trojan horse, and that Dr. Abrams and his staff at the San Francisco General Hospital had essentially proved that marijuana did indeed cause the munchies and boost people's health and immune system. So what happened after that?
Yeah, what did that change?
Well, what happened after that is during a flush budget year, the California legislature approved really the first modern clinical trials in the United States for marijuana, and they authorized $8.7 million, and they established what became known as the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research, which included people such as Dr. Abrams in San Francisco, but the actual research center was centered at the University of California, San Diego, and headed by a very renowned neuropsychiatrist named Igor Grant. And they started taking research applications in 2001, and over the ensuing years, they looked at patients with a variety of conditions, mostly pain-related conditions with net damage to the nervous system, so it could be a spinal cord injury, it could be diabetes. They looked at the effects of spasticity from multiple sclerosis. They injected the ingredient in hot chili peppers under people's skin and had them consume cannabis to measure their pain or their relief from acute pain. And with the exception of some areas of pain acutely introduced, every one of the studies showed measurable benefits in pain reduction. And after that, Dr. Abrams was, in fact, able to go back to the government and get government funding outside of the state of California studies for an additional study that looked at the use of marijuana in conjunction with oxycodone and morphine to see if people taking these highly toxic, highly addictive pharmaceuticals could actually reduce their doses through use of cannabis. And what he found was you could use these drugs in concert with each other and sort of reduce the levels of the pharmaceutical drugs. So the results involved about a total of about 300 research patients. It fell short of the government standards of the sweeping multi-site clinical trials that are needed to evaluate something as a prescription medicine. And that sort of became sort of the government's fallback position. But essentially what the California researchers did was that this was a very promising treatment that merits further study. Now, in the marijuana movement, they'll call cannabis God's medicine or a miracle drug.
Mm-hmm.
These researchers were very, very measured. They said they didn't say anything like that. But ultimately, after as many of the final studies were being published around 2011, 2012, Dr. Grant finally did come out and say that these studies had essentially showed that the government's designation of marijuana as a Schedule I drug with no accepted medical use was simply disingenuous.
Hmm. Although it's also important, you know, that Grant also said that, and you write about it in the book, that you know, the research, he didn't necessarily see it as a ticket for Californians to smoke, you know, pot or create this big industry. And I'm curious, you know, because how much did the research done in California influence decisions, do you think, in other states, including here in Illinois, where they have recently passed and approved, and now it's in effect, a medical marijuana law? Is the reality that those studies, while still small, are the best available and that many states are relying on them to justify giving patients access to medical marijuana?
I think that may well be true, although I continue to be surprised how few people even seem to know that these studies took place in California.
Hmm.
And as I mentioned in this case, the D.C. Circuit Court essentially said there are no studies that establish the medical efficacy of marijuana. I think what's really pushed this along is the social movement as well as the political movement, but the acknowledgement that a lot of people are turning to cannabis for relief. And then it becomes a politically volatile issue because this truly is a unique substance that people both use as medicine and as a recreational drug. And that's what makes this such an interesting issue, such a highly charged political issue. And then beyond that, you have the conflict between federal and state law and often even conflicts inside of states over this issue.
Yeah. We're talking about the challenges of researching medical marijuana with Dr. Suzanne Sisley, clinical assistant professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and with Peter Hecht, author of Weed Land, Inside America's Marijuana Epicenter and How Pot Went Legit. And Dr. Sisley, coming back to you for a moment, he mentioned sort of the much of this is being pushed by movements for various types of social change and advocacy. It's interesting in your case. I mean, if I understand right, you first came to look at marijuana as a potential treatment because you saw your patients were using it.
Oh, yeah. There's just a mountain of growing anecdotal experience from patients that is showing that this drug is remarkably beneficial for certain symptoms. It's not a cure, but it's definitely effective for symptom control. And I think that's what we need to harness is how we can reduce patient suffering. And but, yeah, the movement is tremendous. I mean, after our study got approved, I've been, you know, my voicemail is full every 2 hours at this point, coming from veterans and patients all over the country flooding me with messages about just how thrilled they are that science is finally trumping politics. And to them, that's what it feels like, that politics, the politics of marijuana, that the word marijuana seems to be so politically radioactive that it's clouding the judgment of lawmakers who should be investing in research right now. I mean, with 20 states that have laws on the books, I mean, in Arizona, for example, we've sold 50,000 cards to medical marijuana patients, and yet we're not conducting any active clinical research here to accompany this. And I would submit that that's negligent. I think the state has a duty to conduct research on these cardholders, at least observational studies, to understand how these patients are responding to the medicine, what adverse events are occurring. And we do have some observational data from our poison control centers. Fortunately, the health department did give funding to the poison centers to understand how marijuana, what's been the impact since the law was passed. And what's been fascinating is the poison center gets in Arizona gets about 65,000 calls a year. And out of those 65,000 calls, even since the law was passed 4 years ago, the calls for related to marijuana are still under 100 per year. So that's why I go back to this, the issue that marijuana does seem to have remarkably low toxicity. And when patients do experience adverse events, they're very short-lived because, fortunately, the half-life of the drug is very short. So if patients smoke or vaporize the drug, it's usually, you know, dissipated in a couple hours. And so the calls that Poison Center gets are usually, I feel dizzy, I feel nauseous, whatever. You know, it's very mild symptoms that abate quickly. And so
Doctor, I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to. We just got a few minutes left here. We got a call here from Jeff in Piatone. A call. He say, you know, it's important to remember that people do abuse marijuana, and he says that legalizing it for medical purpose even can open the door another way to abuse the drug. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, the dependency rates with marijuana are about 9 to 16%, which is still remarkably less than alcohol and certainly other illicit drugs. So there is definitely a concern about dependency, and that's why, you know, any of these medical marijuana programs should be accompanied by prevention efforts specifically targeted at young people, because I think it's all the medical community agrees that use among young people should be prevented, avoided as much as possible, unless they're legit medical patients. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Peter might want to chime in on that.
Well, before, just because we're a little bit running out of time here, I want to ask Doctor one more question of you here. You've jumped through a lot of hoops to get to this point, and we've heard Peter talk a bit about the history. There's a long history of having to jump through a lot of hoops. Many people might have thrown up their hands and just said, hey, you know, forget it, I'll try something else. Not you. What are you fighting for in this process?
I'm just fighting because, you know, as a physician who's also a human being, I can't rest knowing that there might be something that's being forced to sit on the shelf that has the potential to reduce human suffering. And I think that's, for me, what it feels like such an injustice to these patients that the progress in the research arena is being stymied by lawmakers who seem to either be uninformed or just deeply prejudicial about the word marijuana. It strikes so much fear in these folks. And hopefully there will continue to be this wave of public support, and maybe we will see a renaissance of marijuana research in this country at some point. But right now it's still a battle every day.
And Peter Hecht, if Dr. Sisley's study goes through and say it does clearly identify a benefit from medical marijuana for PTSD patients, will that, given what we've seen in recent history, will that be a game changer, do you think?
I think it would be a landmark study if it goes through. I think with marijuana there are multiple game changers, but they're all kind of incremental in nature. Obviously, the latest game changer is Washington and Colorado legalizing for recreational use, and the federal government starting to step back and saying that if you enact robust state controls, which are being put in place in Illinois as we speak, that the federal government may not conduct raids and intervene on this industry. There are a couple of things that struck me as very interesting about the proposed study in Arizona. Obviously, the most overwhelmingly interesting thing is it involves veterans and post-traumatic stress, which is very appealing to people nationally who very much sympathize with the veterans and what they've gone through. But the other thing is that they would be using marijuana of up to 12% THC. In the California studies, they use very low-grade government-produced marijuana that bore little resemblance to what people were buying at dispensaries or, for that matter, on the street. Also, this would be the first study that I'm aware of in the United States that would use this this genetically altered breed of marijuana with high CBD, which is the non-psychoactive element of the plant that's believed to deliver analgesic and other healthy benefits. And that was not part of the options in the California study. So it would be both very significantly clinically and very significantly socially. But this is going to be an issue that's going to plod along for a long time, and I think it has to do with marijuana's dual role as both a medicine and a recreational drug, and its long history of being illegal. And when you move from something illegal to legality, there are enormous regulations and steps that have to take place to make it happen.
And I would imagine we're going to learn a lot more, too, as more states continue to roll out medical marijuana laws and even go further. Dr. Suzanne Sisley, a clinical assistant professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. She joined us on the phone from her office there. Dr. Sisley, good luck with the study.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
And Peter Hecht, reporter with the Sacramento Bee, author of the book Weedland, Inside America's Marijuana Epicenter and How Pot Went Legit. Peter, thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
Many thanks to you.
Up next, Illinois put ads in The Onion, among other places, to get young people signed up for health care as we approach the deadline. How did that work? We'll talk with the head of outreach for Get Covered Illinois about their final push for signups. Stay with us. It's Focus on Illinois Public Media.